In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. The big ideas of today will become market-leading companies in the near future, reimagining every sector of the economy for the better. Climate, healthcare, food, transportation, housing, energy, and more. Welcome to Obvious Ideas, a podcast exploring the transformation of the fundamental building blocks of life and society. I'm Andrew Beebe, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. This is episode 5 of our 8-part series on climate. We're digging into the biggest opportunities for founders and professionals in any industry to tackle our climate crisis. Today, we're speaking with Molly Wood, an investor at the early stage venture firm Launch and co-host of This Week in Startups. Molly was a journalist for over 2 decades before she joined Launch at the beginning of this year. She was most recently host and senior editor of Marketplace Tech and a contributing writer at Wired. In this episode, Molly shares what prompted her to take the leap from journalism to investing and the biggest blind spots we have when it comes to climate solutions. Molly Wood, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I am a huge fan, longtime listener, and so it's great to have you on our budding podcast here. One of the things that I found most interesting is that there are a long list of journalists who have become really tremendous venture capitalists, Mike Moritz being one of the most famous, but also Rebecca Caden at USV and Catherine Boyle at Andreessen Horowitz. So how did that transition happen for you in a nutshell?
It would not come as a surprise to anybody in venture capital to say it came because of who I know. However, there is something about being a tech journalist that obviously exposes you to a lot of venture capitalists. And actually, when I started at Marketplace and took over the Marketplace Tech radio show, I very specifically set out to do a series on venture capital. I thought, okay, for a mainstream audience that's interested in tech and business, this is the thing we have to understand. It's this black box. Nobody totally gets the mechanics of it, at least, you know, in the public radio audience landscape. And so I'm going to try to sort of demystify this as much as I can. And the more I did that, of course, the more interesting it became, because it is, as it turns out, like the world's most fun job. And I happen to have known Jason Calacanis for 15 years at least. Jason Calacanis, who is the founder and general partner at Launch, came along at exactly the right moment and said, I want you to come on as an investor, which was an opportunity I definitely could not pass up. Like, come on as a managing director and build a whole new portfolio around climate solutions. And so it was just the perfect opportunity at the perfect moment in time, which, you know, you kind of can't say no to.
And how's it going? What skill sets from journalism are you bringing to investing and how do you apply them every day?
I mean, sometimes I feel like zero skill sets from but no, I mean, it is going fantastically. I am actually astonished at how much I love this. I have not been so energized and excited about anything in a long time. I think there are a couple of skills that are really valuable. One is the sort of fundamental curiosity and just getting excited about talking to lots of people and hearing their stories. Two is the sort of ability to listen to something and hopefully cut through the top level of what you're hearing and then ask a couple questions that get a few levels deeper in an evaluative way. I think there is some natural skepticism that is really valuable. Although I will say that unlike journalism, one of the things I like about this job is that, yes, I have to be skeptical, but I can also be excited and genuinely optimistic about a thing. Like, I can buy it. I can buy the pitch in the room in a way that as a journalist, I think you don't allow yourself to do, and you shouldn't be, right? You should be taking everything a little bit more skeptically.
Skeptical optimism, yeah.
Skeptical optimism, exactly. All the math, though, the math I did not bring over from journalism. And also, I would be lying if I said I have not fallen into the junior investor trap of wanting to invest in everybody that I've met with because it is so exciting and fun, and they're really charismatic. So it's been actually a little bit of an interesting process of like, making the same mistakes that everybody makes and being super excited about everything and then remembering like, oh, wait a second, I know how to do this. You know, just because I'm in a meeting with a founder and in a different instantiation of a conversation with a CEO does not mean that I don't know how to have a conversation with a CEO, which I do. And I'm getting better every single day at sort of remembering that those are the fundamental skills that got me here in the first place. And as I do that, I'm like, oh, okay, this is getting like a lot easier to weed this out and put this over here and be like, oh, no, thank you. That is sketchy as hell. And actually, if anything, the big challenge for me has been very intentionally merging that skill set.
So let's talk about that. You've been meeting with even more climate founders than you had in the past role. And over the period of time that you've really been focused on climate, which is years now, how have you seen that landscape of founders change or evolve?
I would say the biggest difference is that now they exist. I'd say around 2018 is when I really started to turn my attention to climate solutions in the technology space. That's when I realized, like, okay, there's a lens for me as a tech and business journalist. This is obviously a business story with a total addressable market of the planet, the whole planet, and a big technology story because that's how humans have always saved their asses in the past. I actually came to it initially with a lens of adaptation and resilience and thought, okay, well, that's a perfect place for technology to be applied, which is how not to die. I called the series How We Survive. A lot of these companies didn't exist. I mean, it's like I went looking for companies that had not been born yet.
And that was the Marketplace series.
Yeah, it was a Marketplace series that started out as sort of like an ongoing series and then ended up as an 8-episode narrative documentary style podcast.
I mean, there's so much to focus on in climate. How did you pick the topics like lithium mining or other areas? And are you able to sort of apply that same kind of narrowing of the field to the investment work you're doing today?
It's probably not the same filter, although the years covering tech and specifically covering tech at Marketplace did help me figure out that a filter is what you need. And so at Marketplace, it was like, is it tech and is it business? And if it's not both of those things, it's just not for us. And when I started looking into tech solutions, it was really through the lens of adaptation and resilience. That broadened out over time, especially as it became clear that sort of adaptation measures are often mitigation measures. I'm still interested in the company that's going to create like the diamond coating. This was in one of Kim Stanley Robinson's books, the diamond coating that you would put around the bottom of buildings so that when New York City is submerged, the water stays out. If you're working on that in real life, call me and Andrew. And we...
Let's do that deal.
Let's do that deal. To answer your question more specifically about how I'm thinking about the climate filters, it really... It's still a little bit broad, but it's based in what I grew up with. So I think about what changes a system, what has a gigaton level impact, and what can change behavior. And for me, my background is in consumer technology. My first job in tech journalism was at CNET, and I actually do really believe in the power of consumers to drive change with purchasing decisions. So things that can change consumer behavior, even if consumers don't realize it, I think has a lot of impact. And then because of my time at Marketplace, I'm like all about your nerdy financial instrument. Bring me the thing that can be securitized as a green bond, your alternative investment platform for renewable energy, the thing that is going to benefit the most from the SEC regulating risk as a financial.
Oh, I've got so many deals for you, Molly. This is going to be great.
Oh, my God. That like Fed level macroeconomic stuff is my jam, it turns out. I love that. And then in terms of translating it to climate, it's the same thing as reporting. And I think this is applicable in both journalism and investing, which is like, you take this really big problem and it seems intractable, but every problem has components. And so you start to break this problem down to its component parts. And that, for example, is how I landed on lithium. I got really into electrification, big topic, massive impact on this space. So then what are the component parts of electrification? Well, it's renewable energy, it's EVs, it's electrifying your home, it's decarbonizing via electrification. That takes batteries. In 2019, I became obsessed with batteries. You know, you start talking to somebody about batteries and then someone's like, oh, well, do you know about the Salton Sea? There's this massive reservoir of lithium there. And there was this kind of wackadoodle Australian down in the Salton Sea who was trying to extract lithium from brine. And it turned into the foundation of this series, How We Survive, which is all about efforts across America to secure a domestic supply of lithium for battery creation. Just as in reporting and finding interesting companies, it's just someone who has heard a cool thing that might be happening. And you're like, oh, that's my thing. I'm into that cool thing. And then you call them up and off you go.
What do you say to people who are looking for those bridges to get out of the, call them bronze handcuff, you know, mid-level jobs that they are excited about, but they've really had an awakening around climate and want to make the leap over? How can people more easily take those risks?
Well, there's probably a way to take that risk at the company you're at if you're bored there, because every employee has power. I actually interviewed a founder who is trying to help companies divest 401k investments from fossil fuels. They've created a mutual fund that is fossil fuel free, and it's effectively like the S&P 465, right? It's basically the S&P 500 minus big fossil fuel companies. And so she said it's both a product and a movement, because if you're inside a company, you have the opportunity to say, hey, HR, I would really like for our 401k options to include one that is divested from fossil fuels. And evidently, somebody separately said to me recently, if you divest from fossil fuels in your portfolio, that can have 30 times more impact than going vegan for your whole life, which may come as a relief to some of us.
I think famously BP, they really sort of concocted the idea of a carbon footprint as a way to sort of put the burden back on the consumer and say, hey, if you're so green and enthusiastic about climate change, why don't you take care of the problem that we're creating? And I've always been of the belief that eventually stakeholders and consumers are going to push back to the companies and say, hey, why don't you take care of it? I'm open to paying a little bit more or doing something, but I don't want to have to manage this myself. Where do you land there? Are you only trying to do these sort of infrastructure things, maybe on the deep technical side and then on the underpinnings of the financial institutions, or would you also do more of a consumer-facing solution?
Oh, I would definitely do a consumer-facing solution in addition to a, you know, big systemic financial change. Because I think, you know, what you just said is seeing the consumer push back on these companies and saying, no, you have to deal with it, is something that we do through our buying decisions. We create markets. You don't have to really look any farther than high fructose corn syrup. A bunch of research came out that said this shit is poison. It is unsafe in any amount. And I think we could argue that the climate crisis is also unsafe in any amount at this point. And consumers said, get that out of our food. And so for the most part, it's out of food now. And somebody said to me on Twitter the other day, you know, if everybody set their AC 3 degrees higher all summer long this year, if everyone in America did that, that would be massively impactful. I think it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that individuals can't deal with a collective problem, because what are collectives made up of? That's just an absurdly self-defeating perspective. Like, do I think that us recycling, when it turns out recycling may no longer even be real, is the way to solve the climate crisis? No. But anybody in the top 15 or 20% of earners, you better be spending the money to get an electric heat pump in your home, to get an EV, to get more efficient windows, to buy every single product that you possibly can that is more climate friendly, because that's how we create markets that are then accessible to people who can't currently afford them in the rest of the world.
Awesome. Well said. Let's talk about silver bullets for climate, because wouldn't it be great?
Wouldn't it?
So if you could just list off the one silver, no. I've looked at the energy, the climate, let's call it decarbonization transition, in three buckets: from energy generation, and then mobility, and ultimately industry. And if we decarbonize those three big buckets, you're sort of decarbonizing the entire world. Maybe down to one of those three buckets, do you think there are any major silver bullets that are in development or in the process of being fired that really can have at least 30% or greater impact if globally implemented?
I mean, I think we have to say it would be nuclear fusion, the technology that no one totally understands but believes will be the key to unlocking unlimited, free, clean energy. Like, imagine what we could do with unlimited energy that would never have to be produced from fossil fuels.
Yeah, and I would also put electrification of all mobility. Obviously, that's a big one. It's not a single silver bullet. It's probably a bunch.
Right. There's also the part that you know very well, which is that we sort of already have the technology. Like, it's the sun. We have solar. If we can just make it ubiquitous, maybe tweak the panels here and there. I talked to like a guy who wants to 3D print them so they're like bee wings or something, that they're crystalline and they can improve that. You know, sure. Great. Let's do that. Let's do all of that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm of the mind that solar plus storage plus wind plus storage is a pretty strong silver bullet today. And we are in the process of really scaling the heck out of that stuff. So I think there's hope there. Molly, what are the biggest blind spots we have when it comes to climate solutions?
I suppose that the biggest blind spot has been in thinking that climate solutions are actually obviously climate related, if that makes sense, right? It's this growing realization that every story is a climate story, that every company is a climate company, and that the solutions will come in setting a lot of tiny things in motion that will ultimately upend systems.
Great. What about, just for fun, let's do some buzzword bingo, crypto and climate. How do you look at that? And have you done any deals in that space? Are you thinking about it? Because, you know, you mentioned financial instruments. Carbon offsets and crypto itself, or the blockchain in particular, is just really like those are two monster instruments that are not yet really fully merged.
Yeah, they're really not. I've been sort of noodling on how to make this an essay or a book of some sort for a while. And then, of course, the New York Times came along and published an article in April about how in Europe specifically, sustainability investments are taking a backseat to all of these Web3 and crypto and NFT projects that just seem super sexy and fun and like quick money right now. I think right now crypto and Web3 is actually probably our biggest competition when it comes to attention and money in climate solutions. And that there's very little right now that I have seen, at least, that can benefit from being on the blockchain in terms of a climate solution, even a financial instrument. Like maybe there's a great argument that down the road, this needs to be on the blockchain and it could be executed through smart contracts. And if it were decentralized, then maybe like banks would get a, but frankly, right now, nothing is going to be more impactful than the Federal Reserve saying banks are on the hook for the financial risk of their investments that come from climate, or the SEC saying, if you are a public company, you have to report this, full stop. Get the traditional money moving first, and then we can talk about the decentralized money. And I'm still waiting for everybody, you know, all the big promises to come through about, well, as soon as everything is on proof of stake, then it'll just be, you know, it'll only use as much energy as a Google search to mint an NFT. Call me when that's true, but right now it's not. And I think these two technologies are at odds with each other.
So what is your top three list, silver bullet or not, within climate that you believe is highly investable?
Is highly investable, is it? Yeah. Because fusion's going to take a long time and a lot of money, and it's probably not venture scale. For me, I think these financial and metrics tools, as much as I initially was like, well, that sort of feels like a cop-out, right? Like, I want to be in the big fusion adventure. And I mean, listen, I just talked to an electric airplane company that I am definitely emailing you about, because let's do that. That's massively impactful. But it turns out metrics really do matter and are potentially venture scale. Like, I don't want to be stuck in the software as a service universe, and I don't intend to be, but I actually really do think that analytics tools that can move money and that can respond to what I hope are regulatory incentives are going to be really powerful. But I will tell you, my first official investment is in a company that's doing zero waste grocery, and one of them just went out of business. And I hope that, you know, my lady makes it, because I think that there's so, I want that to exist. Like, I want wholesale goods packaged in beautiful glass, rentable pantry that's delivered to me in an electric vehicle. Yeah, I'm paying a lot for that.
All day, right?
All day long.
Yeah. And this measurement question on the climate side, I mean, we're seeing over and over again, ESG or environmental, social, and governance headlines left and right, but usually followed by, not quite at the top of the fold, the story later on about how those measurements turn out to be wildly inaccurate or challenged in terms of the way that they can truly be used, whether it's decarbonizing a fossil fuel free 401k or something solely because everybody just moved to Microsoft, Google, and Netflix in that 401k, which can look good, but can be concentrated in a different way that may not be beneficial to them over the long term. So finding ways to create those monster opportunities that are maybe SaaS driven or, you know, maybe just information type companies can also be necessary parts of the overall scale. Let's do a couple of like rapid fire direct air capture of carbon dioxide for removal of CO2 from the atmosphere mechanically or chemically.
If that happens at scale, that's great. If I were going to pick a buzzword, though, in our space, I would probably be more inclined toward green hydrogen than direct air capture, because I sort of feel like the second one feels farther out and it feels like an opportunity to just do exactly what we're doing, but with a safety net.
Say more about green hydrogen.
Hydrogen is obviously highly appealing as a fuel source for freight and airlines and shipping. Hydrogen is really promising as a fuel because it's zero emissions, as you well know, but the way we make it now is actually terrible. It's with natural gas and we just like superheat it or whatever. And green hydrogen can accomplish the same thing, but without the use of fossil fuels. And green hydrogen right now essentially doesn't exist. Like everyone is like, blue hydrogen, it's so great, but it's not. It has a very high back-end cost in fossil fuels. So if we could put enough money and time and science into creating green hydrogen production at scale, then you're replacing jet fuel and diesel in cargo shipping, which is, I think cargo shipping is like, that's how 90% of the world's goods move through commercial shipping. That's massive. I don't want any stupid plant somewhere to still be burning coal, but we can capture the carbon. Maybe this is like the difference between investable and not investable, but philosophically, I would be happier to invest in green hydrogen and something that is not offsets than offsets and direct air capture.
Molly, you're at a firm that now you do climate as I do it here at Obvious, but you also, like me, have partners who are working on other areas. When founders come in with other technology solutions for other areas, crypto or SaaS or whatever, do you see them occasionally trying to figure out if there's a climate angle to what they're doing?
I do think that most companies are starting to wake up to the fact that they are some version of a climate company. Whenever we have founders on our podcast This Week in Startups, I try to ask them, like, how are you thinking about climate? And I can give you one example of a time that it turned out really interestingly, which is GoPuff, which is grocery delivery, and which is a one of those fields that we sort of didn't realize had as big a climate impact as it did. I mean, delivery obviously has a pretty big climate impact, but it's only recently that consumers started to say, oh my God, this delivery comes with way too much packaging. And also you're just driving it around all the time in a gas-powered car. And what are you doing about that? And so it seemed like it could have been a bit of a wild card when I asked the question, like, hey, how are you thinking about climate as you conduct your business? And the GoPuff CEO said, oh, I just got out of a 4-hour meeting about that. We're thinking about it all the time. And they're thinking about it because of consumers and the questions that consumers are asking, which is, how did you deliver this? Why does it have so much plastic? Can you make this packaging smaller? What kind of car are you using? How are you maximizing efficiency? Because the kids really care about it.
Yeah. And we certainly see it in the valuation of companies like Rivian, where they are making a consumer-facing vehicle, but they're also making a B2B solution for Amazon, one of their biggest shareholders. And that is really driven by that consumer demand pushing up to the companies that supply us our goods, demanding a real change.
Yeah. Also, that truck is so hot, for lack of a better way to put it.
I'm in line. Molly, we always close the show with a simple question. In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. So come 2030, what are we going to look back at as an obvious idea that today seems totally crazy?
I think aquaculture and blue tech. I think ocean-based solutions are going to turn out to have been a much bigger deal than we ever realized. I'm reading this book now called Eat Like a Fish, about a former commercial fisherman who is now doing regenerative ocean-based agriculture. I mean, the amount of carbon sink that is available in the ocean, let alone the amount of food that can be farmed. And I'm not talking about fish at all. Like, he farms seaweed and shellfish. and is like, imagine being a chef at Chez Panisse and discovering that there were like 1,000 vegetables that you never knew about. That's the ocean. And here's this like massive part of our burning planet that we hardly know anything about. And it's an incredible resource for sequestering carbon, for creating more sustainable food, for like a whole new universe of agriculture. And I suspect that by 2030, we'll be like, duh.
I love it. And I completely agree. One of my first investments was in a machine learning, machine vision technology company in the aquaculture space called Expert C, now thriving in the shrimp aquaculture domain, really helping to bring transparency and sustainability to that field. And I think that we're going to see that again and again.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Well, Molly, thank you so much for coming on our show. This has been terrific. Looking forward to the next conversation.
Me too. Thanks for having me on.
That was Molly Wood, an investor at Launch and co-host of This Week in Startups. Next week on the show, we speak with Nan Rantzehoff, head of climate at Stripe.
We have to compress with climate and with carbon removal 10 to 15 years worth of progress into the next 3 to 5. And if you want to do that, you need a different set of interventions than those that exist today.
Obvious Ideas is produced by Obvious Ventures in partnership with Pod People. Obvious invests in purpose-driven founders reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team, Gabe Kleiman, Aniko Steffen, and Emily Brady from Obvious, and the team at Pod People, Rachel King, Amy Machado, Emily Shaw, Madison Lusby, and Jason Mack. I'm Andrew Beebe. Thanks for listening.